Hi, my name is Bruce Perham. Welcome to my podcast series, Trauma from the Frontline. In this series, we'll be interviewing a wide range of people that work in the frontline industries who will be sharing their professional and personal thoughts and ideas about working in the field and some of the challenges that they all confront. Hi, today I've got Jennifer, who is Mia's mum, and Jennifer's agreed to come along and talk about her experiences of watching her work as a correction officer and the impact that it had on her. Jennifer, what were your thoughts when she came home and said, "Mum, I'm thinking of applying to be a correction officer"? What was going through your mind?
There are a lot of thoughts going through my mind. One was certainly apprehension. She was looking for something that would give her a career and a career path. Yes. She'd always been a person who liked working with people, wanted to help people, and she had, wanted to develop something that she could build a career in. And she had looked at going into the police force, had gone through a lot of the interviewing process, but was unsuccessful, couldn't reapply for another 12 months or so. And so this seemed to her another option and perhaps a stepping stone if she wanted to go into the police force. Yes. Later on. So from that perspective, I was happy for her because she was looking at a career path and doing something she really was enthusiastic about, but I was apprehensive about what that would mean for her in terms of just her daily role.
Yes.
And the potential danger that she could be in.
Yes. So in the early days, I mean, how was it looking to you, in terms of her going off to the prison and coming home and,
Well, during the training process, she bonded with the group that she was training in, and so she was keen and enthusiastic, putting in the effort, all the work that was required. But then when she moved from the training program into the field, that was a whole different ball game.
So what did you notice as mum?
Certainly from the time that she finished the training and went into the prison system, there was a big change and there was a lot of stress associated with that. I guess going back to the graduation, the thing that stuck in my mind, we saw them all graduating and they were all happy and we met her friends and, they were from all walks of life. Mm-hmm. And I remember two people speaking. So one was, I think, one of the government bureaucrats that wasn't the minister but probably directly associated with the minister, and I can't remember her name or who she was.
That doesn't matter, yeah.
And she gave a speech when they graduated and talked about the potential for change in the system, and these were the people, that new people that were going to bring new life into the system and create change and better the whole system. And then there was a gentleman who was, I don't know whether he was in charge of the correctional services overall, but obviously quite high up. And afterwards we were talking to him, he was mingling with the people. And again, there was this sort of feeling of change coming into the system. And so I remember talking to my husband afterwards saying, it's an interesting concept because change rarely happens from the bottom up.
Yes.
These are new people coming in. They're young. They don't have the experience. How does this all work?
It's a fair responsibility on them, isn't it?
Yeah. And I just thought it was interesting to hear that being spoken about at their graduation. So what was presented sort of during training and graduation and what was reality when they walked into everyday working life was so different. And it was only a short program. 8 weeks is not a long time to train people to walk into that environment.
Mm. Mm. So what was she verbalising in those early months? I mean, what was she sharing with you about what she was going through?
I think, do you mean in the early months of training or when she went into the
system? Once she started work, yeah.
Very stressful, and I think the major stress was coming from the colleagues she was working with.
Yes.
So in those early days, my greatest concerns for her was in dealing with the people that she was working with rather than the prisoners. Yes. And inmates that they were looking after. I guess And I don't know a lot about the prison system, so I was fairly naive in all of this, or very naive in all of this. So I sort of thought, well, there's policies and practices in place that will protect her from the inmates. So my concern was how she was dealing with the treatment she was getting from her colleagues. And some of it was brutal. I mean, there were many stories. I guess I was shocked because I've never worked in a workplace where people were treated like that. And I could not understand how in this 21st century, in a country of this nature, how people could be treated in their workplace like that.
Yeah. What sorts of things did she tell you, you know?
It was when she first started, the thing that struck me was that she would go to work and she'd be moved from one section to the next section, and so she'd be constantly moved from section to section. So there was no ability to sort of work in one section where you could get used to the routine, the people. So there was this constant stress of change.
Different people.
There was this element, from my perspective, it seemed like they put them in, they'd had 8 weeks training, they go into the system, and then they're expected to know everything, how the system works, what they're supposed to do on a daily basis, without actually anybody mentoring them or showing them through that process. And then if they asked questions, they were put down because they were asking questions. It was almost like an initiation process, yes. I guess. But because it was constantly moving in each section, although they had overriding similar ways of doing things, every section would have its own little idiosyncrasies, I suppose, and yet she was supposed to know that. So this constant moving every day just added to the stress because she couldn't get her feet, she couldn't sort of ground, get used to one area before she was moved into another area. And I don't know whether that happened for every new graduate, whether some were put into permanent spots where they might be there for 6 or 8 weeks, or whether that was a common thing.
It seems to, you know, I don't know, for me as an outsider, it seems to be a bit rotational rather than you go into a unit and that's it. Some do, some officers are in a unit, but I don't know how you get in there, but I may well be that it's part of for the new trainees, give them a look at the whole prison, but I really understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And you can't get to be familiar with the system. And so when you know, is there a point where you start to become a bit concerned about her, you know, that you stressed from the beginning? Was there a certain point where you thought, my God, I'm really worried about her?
I think from the start, seeing the stress, and she has always been a happy-go-lucky person, so it was watching the joy drain out of her, the joy of life. It was hard to watch. And Malcolm and I, my husband, we just kept saying to her, you know, this is not worth it. You will walk away, you know, find something else that you like to do, because we could just see her mentally going downhill.
Well, we talked and she sort of, we used the word confusion, or that she didn't know what was happening to her. Did that come through to you and Malcolm, that it's almost she was in a situation that she just didn't know what to do, you know?
Yeah, she sort of very much had it in her mind that she needed to succeed at this, and that if she walked away that she would not only be a failure but let herself down. And we tried to talk to her about the fact that, you know, maybe you're just not suited for this work, you know, there's more important things in life than putting yourself through this to prove that you can do something. But there was that, no, I need to go back, because if I don't, I'll be not weaker, but that she won't have given it her best shot to achieve.
Yes, it's almost, you know, proving to herself that she can do it.
And so when she took that time out, and I went with her to the GP, and she was good. She gave her the leave, and she, you know, started her on antidepressants, and she referred her to a psychologist. So we put things in place, but she was not in good shape.
Yes.
And, you know, every so often they'd be ringing to say, you're coming back. There was no support from her workplace, apart from some individual colleagues and her squad, the squad leader that had been involved with her training. But that was on an individual basis. It wasn't an organisational thing. It was more pressure, look, you know, how long are you going to drag this leave on for, sort of thing.
Yes, and when so the inference back, was that she's rotting the system or...
what's wrong with you, you know, come on, your work colleagues are covering for you, sort of thing, you know, in
so
terms
a bit of...
of
the guilt.
Yeah, which didn't help.
Did that just continue on? Because she talked about the changes that she felt was happening to herself and she mentioned she became a lot more aggressive. And what did you see as mum and dad in how it changed her?
Her enjoyment of life had certainly almost been drained out of her. I think her energies went into getting herself prepared to go back to work. So on days off she might be a little bit better. But then as time got closer to go back to work, you could see her energy being put into gaining the inner strength to get herself back there. Certainly, yes, we did notice that her language was probably, well, she says she was swearing more and things like that. So we did notice those things. You just
harder
worried.
To connect with?
Yes, she probably didn't divulge. I don't think... Even listening to her while she was speaking with you, you sort of go back and you realise that she didn't talk a lot about some of the incidents with the inmates, more about the dealing with her colleagues.
Yeah. And from, you know, probably my perception, the actual what you experience with the prisoners is so different to what you experience with the culture. And often officers will say, well, you know, I can't tell my family the trauma we see with the prisoners because it's trauma and it's distressing. But maybe she felt, I can't talk about what I see, but I can more talk about how I'm being treated, So was that your sense that you'd never heard a lot about what she's experiencing, the prisoner side of it? But more about how she was being treated by her colleagues.
Yeah. We did talk a little bit about in terms of things that she'd seen. She had an incident where urine was thrown over her and things like that, and that she had seen some slashing and things like that. But it was more, maybe I didn't focus on that side of it as much either. It was more about the reaction of her colleagues and how that put her in a different place rather than the actual what she'd witnessed.
It's actually a crucial point, you know, in terms of if, she's not alone, you know, but if officers were treated more supported in an environment that understood the reaction, would that make it easier to manage what you're actually dealing with the prisoners?
Yes.
And I suspect it would, you know.
And I felt, I know I might be jumping around a bit here, but I felt when they left their training program and went into the prison system, it was like lambs to the slaughter.
Yeah.
And I felt that sometimes they were put in vulnerable situations because, again, it was that process of them going into a work environment, not being fully familiar with practices because you can only cover so much in 8 weeks. And there was one incident where she had talked about, and I mightn't have all the facts right, but the gist of it was that the one of her training colleagues had gone into a prison cell and had been beaten by the prisoner. And part of the problem was that there was some coding or some system on the door that indicated that he should not have gone into that cell, but he wasn't aware of that. So it just made me wonder how, with these practices of not mentoring, you know, teaching them the ropes and things like that, how vulnerable they are and at risk they are because of what their colleagues are actually doing rather than, the prisoners themselves. So it's almost like there's this hierarchy because in your book, and it talked a lot about, you know, how they support each other, professionally and look after each other and look out for each other. But it didn't seem that to me. The new colleagues were on a different rung altogether, and you had to work your way up to get into that point where you had this protection sort of atmosphere. But until you proved yourself, I felt there you were vulnerable. Look, maybe I've read that wrong.
No,
I don't know,
really good point, Jennifer, because and Jennifer was referencing the book I wrote, Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger, but I didn't really cover the complexity of the structures within. I mean, I'd certainly heard officers talk about that in terms of all sorts of different things, in terms of what you needed to do to be a part of a group that's accepted. But yes, I didn't really deal with that, but it's there, and that complexity, and officers often share that they don't feel they fit and that they're made to be very aware of that they don't fit. So there's clearly a lot going on there that people like me wouldn't know. It's really people that work in the system that get direct exposure to that. When you hear your daughter say, you know, oh, I had urine thrown all over me today, or feces flicked at me, or, you know, I had a slash up, and were you and Malcolm sort of thinking, why are you doing this? Why are you putting yourself through this?
Yeah.
You know, was it hard to understand? I know you've said about, you know, that she needed to go back and prove herself, and I understand that, but was it really hard to watch that psyching up to go back to work, to have those things happen to her?
Yeah, it was very hard to watch and hard to understand in terms of, you know, just I think that the fact that she was so vulnerable, there was nowhere she could go, because if she reported anything, it wouldn't go anywhere, and then she'd be the one that was ostracised. So where do you go with it? You actually are left holding it.
You're on your own.
And that's a hard place to be, especially, you know, I think for a female too. I mean, it's hard across the board for all new people, but I think maybe for females it might be even harder. I don't know. It's just you didn't know how to protect. Well, you couldn't protect her.
No.
And she was the one that was choosing to go into that environment. And just watching the disintegration of her spirit, I suppose you would say.
Yeah. Were you feeling that you were losing your daughter?
Yes. Yeah. And I just worried how far down she would go and where it would all end up.
How low did she go?
When she took the time out and before I suppose the antidepressants were starting to have an effect, I just worried. I really worried for her. You worry about her safety. You worry about whether she would perhaps get to the point where she might take her own life.
So you did worry about that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not saying she was at that point, but
no,
I could see it going down that pathway.
If it kept going the way it was, it could swamp her.
Yeah. But also just not being able to enjoy life. And, you know, she was only a young woman. She should be out there in the prime of her life, enjoying life, not bogged down because of work.
Yeah, and having those around her, feeling their spirits being, you know, dragged away. At what point do you think she started to recognise that this just isn't in my best interests?
That's a really hard one to answer. I think she has the most amazing resilience and strength, because I couldn't have done it.
No,
I would have walked away.
I think most of us couldn't have done it.
So she did, over a period of time, she took a secondment out of the prison system and worked in community services where they were dealing with people who were, you know, coming out on parole and things like that. So that made a bit of a difference, because it was the immediate danger and pressure was off her. So I think that was a turning point. But she was still within the system to a degree, and it was only a temporary secondment.
Yes.
So it sort of gave us a little window of
breathing space.
And I think when that secondment finished, if I remember correctly, then she went back to the women's prison system. And that that had its challenges, but I guess she was more seasoned, if you'd like to say, by then, and so she handled that probably better. And because she was more experienced, perhaps colleagues didn't put her through the same stresses that they might have if she was completely new to the system.
She felt like she was two people. It was the person that went to work and it was the person that was at home. So you must have been deeply worried about
yeah,
that.
And she did leave the system and went on to do work with animals.
Right.
That the relief when she went out of that system was massive.
Yes. Mm. Yes. How... when she decided to leave and she left and she shared, and she will have shared with you too, I'm sure, the anger that she feels. Mm. And I've invited her back again and we'll talk more next time about that anger. Mm. Were you angry at how she'd been treated in,
yes,
in that system?
Yeah, very angry with what it did to Hannah, with the system itself and the fact that it can flourish still today, which I think is why your book and these podcasts are so important, because anything that can bring about some change, because it definitely has to come from the top. And until there's a will and recognition that it needs to change and it needs to change significantly, nothing will happen. And I worry about all these new people going in and how much damage is left. People work in the system and we know that they're damaged and broken souls, really. I don't think anybody that will work in that system would not be damaged over time. But what happens to all the people that go in and can't cope and leave? Where are they left? Because the trauma that they're put through is life-changing and life-lasting for some. And none of that is ever tracked or monitored. It's all just ignored. And there would be a lot of people, I'm sure, that... have paid a high price for going into that working environment.
They certainly have paid a very high price. Is she fully back yet, or is it a journey for her?
I think it's a journey. Yeah. I think that she's a lot more anxious as a person than she used to be, and she's experiencing anxiety and working on how to manage that, but I'm sure the foundation of a lot of that has been as a consequence of what she's been through. Mm. You know, she's enjoying life and so, yeah, it's a journey.
So you're starting to see her on the way back.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And look, well, I'll talk to her next time a bit more about that post. We didn't have time to talk about it today. But, you know, the hypervigilance that officers need to have to do their work on a good day and the anxiety that that creates over time, and then it just doesn't go away.
No.
And so, yeah, we'll talk about it. It's really important, you know, because it's – that is years before, and that's what you're saying, you know, the long term. Look, thank you so much for coming and just sharing, you know, your experiences. And I guess in a way, you know, your family members are as isolated or more isolated because you don't have access to, you watch what's happening, but you have no access to anybody to go, hang on a minute, look after my daughter better, or I would imagine it's a very powerless place to be.
It is. And even when she left, I do have anger and frustration, and I did think about writing a letter, you know, to the powers that be. I didn't in the end because I just felt like it wouldn't change anything.
In this day and age, you can't find anywhere a postal address to send it. You know, these systems, you know, you can't write a letter to anybody because there's no postal addresses to where to send it. So, you know, and it's part of a broader, you know, how do people provide feedback? It's not easy to provide feedback.
No.
But in sharing your views today, I mean, that you know, provides an insight into just how challenging it is for families.
No.
All righty. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good on you. Bye. Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline.
If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. If you would like to get in touch with me, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636.